This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, everyone, so time for the Week in Review, and we will start with healthcare.
Obamacare isn't working. By nearly any measure, it has failed, and no amount of 11th-hour reality denying or buck-passing by Democrats is going to change the fact that more Americans are going to get hurt unless we do something.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about the formerly secret Senate health care plan officially revealed by Republicans this week and officially reviled by Democrats such as Elizabeth Warren.
These cuts are blood money. People will die. Let's be very clear. Senate Republicans are paying for tax cuts for the wealthy with American lives.
But four GOP senators are already saying they can't vote for the bill, but that's because it doesn't go far enough for them to ending what they don't like about Obamacare. Here's Senator Rand Paul speaking to NBC's Today Show.
We add regulatory mandates that elevate the cost so poor people can't buy it and healthy young people won't buy it, but then we say to everyone, oh, but it's okay, you can get it after you're sick. That is a terrible sort of situation. Those perverse incentives are what are destroying the insurance market.
So there is much to discuss this week, and our Week in Review panelists are here to help us out. And joining us today is Tiziana Deering. She's co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's so good to see you again.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also with us is Evan Horowitz. He's a quick study columnist for the Boston Globe. Evan, great to have you.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, so since you're the newbie to the Week in Review table, you get first crack. What's your thoughts on the healthcare bill unveiled by the Senate this week, finally?
I was surprised by how similar it was to previous iterations, and appalled by the direction it took.
Oh, pithy. Okay, great. Tiziana, your thoughts?
No, fair. The noob is concise. That's supposed to happen on this show. Poor people lose out. That's my the first thing that I notice, the first thing that I care about is this is a slash and burn approach to Medicaid. And I keep coming back to more than 75% of poor kids, more than 60% of people in nursing homes, more than 60% of people, children with disabilities rely on Medicaid. And this is slash and burn.
So bring the discussion back to Medicaid is the way to do it. I mean, it sounds like the bill was supposed to be all along repeal and replace Obamacare. But by far, the biggest changes have nothing to do with elements of Obamacare. Don't get me wrong, there are big changes worth talking about. But this gets us way, way back before Obamacare. Mm-hmm. This is a set of cuts to Medicaid that would shrink that program to levels we haven't seen in decades.
Right. So, I mean, so it's the Medicaid cuts, really, which I think are the heart of, like you're saying, the heart of the major changes here. But let's get some perspective from President Donald Trump. He had some things to say about the Senate's bill. He was speaking at a technology event as the Senate debated the bill or discussed it on Thursday.
Obamacare is a disaster. It's dead, totally dead. And we're putting in a plan today that's going to be negotiated. We'd love to have some Democrat support, but they're obstructionists. They'll never support. We won't get one, no matter how good it is. But we will hopefully get something done, and it'll be something with heart and very meaningful.
So, Tiziana, I mean, regardless of what one thinks of the president, I think he's making an interesting point here because Mitch McConnell has said the senators will be allowed to add unlimited amendments to this bill. Granted, it's on a very compressed timeline, but on the other hand, the Senate's process can and will still go forward. So aren't Democrats perhaps losing an opportunity to be active participants in forming and shaping this bill?
Yeah, I think to some extent that's true. I don't know that I can identify any player in this whole situation who I wouldn't say at some level is behaving badly or making bad choices. This whole thing feels like it's about politics at every level and at every step, rather than, what legislation could we pass that would improve what we already have and create a quality healthcare system for Americans in the United States? Now, you know, that being said, I also want to go back to what the president and Mitch McConnell both said about declaring Obamacare dead. I feel like that scene from The Holy Grail where they're carting out their dead and there's a guy on the wheelbarrow going, hey, I'm not dead yet. You know, I don't buy that Obamacare is dead and therefore needs to be wheeled out on a gurney and replaced with something. I think the Democrats have gone too far by saying, you use the word repeal and I won't talk to you. I'm taking my marbles and going home. But Obamacare is not dead.
Well, I'm going to jump in here because that's a fair point. But on the other hand, just today on NPR this morning, I was hearing that, you know, once again, we have another round of insurers pulling out of exchanges. And they were talking about how, I believe it's Iowa, hopefully I'm remembering the right state, that 90% of the counties there have no insurer in the Obamacare exchanges. Okay, so that's not Obamacare being dead, but there are places in this country where the exchanges aren't up to snuff. They aren't what President Obama had promised when the bill was passed.
That seems right, except a total distraction. That is, it's no defense of a bill that guts the exchanges to say that they're having trouble. If you want to fix them, you could pass a bill to fix them, and it wouldn't actually be that complicated. There are small steps. I'm not going to go through them because, as I say, it seems like there are bigger issues. And really, what's going on here is I don't think Democrats failing to participate in the discussion. I don't think there's any avenue for the Democrats to shape this bill. I don't think there ever was any avenue for the Democrats to shape this bill. So I don't blame them at all for starting with opposition. I do think there was hope that the Senate would craft a bill that made more economic sense than this bill, that after the House debacle, there would be a shift towards something more moderate, and that just didn't happen. So I think a lot of people have been surprised by that, and the Democrats in particular have been surprised by that.
Well, let me just throw in here that President Obama himself actually put a Facebook post up about the Senate's health care bill, and he wrote, quote, simply put, if there's a chance you might get sick or get old or start a family, this bill will do you harm. And then he went on to say, and small tweaks over the course of the next couple of weeks under the guise of making these bills easier to stomach cannot change the fundamental meanness at the core of this legislation. That's from a Facebook post from President Barack Obama. But I guess I find myself in the position here of trying to point to the arguments that Republican leadership are making in why they presented this bill. And one thing that Mitch McConnell has said, and again, let's debate it at this table, but he says that regarding those Medicaid cuts, that that's actually what it's going to take to strengthen Medicaid for the long run because of the size of the program and the unwieldiness of it on the federal budget.
Yeah. You know, and honestly, I only hit you, baby, because I want you to be better. Right. There is a level of this that is really we are going to gut this for ideological purposes. A person holding a strong ideological belief that there's a different way to do distribution and that subsidizing people's long-term health care at 95% of the expenses is not the way to do it is not an illegitimate statement. But that's what's going on here. Fundamental ideological differences in how we are supposed to provide for each other. So just say it and own it. This is not strengthening Medicaid in the long term.
But they are saying it, but they're owning what they see as a completely different outcome.
It does not feel to me like they are owning it. This all feels like jujitsu to me.
Because there's no actual argument behind statements like that. It seems to me there are sort of two rationales behind this bill. One of them, it allows Republicans to cut taxes. If you cut Medicaid spending, that frees up money to cut taxes. That's sort of rationale one. Rationale two is, this is the kind of bill that might get 50 votes. Right. It's not an ideological rationale. It's not, oh, we want a free market system. It's this is the way to get enough hardline conservatives and enough moderates together on something that is about health care and that undoes Obamacare enough that we can go back to voters and say, yes, we repealed Obamacare.
Right. At the end of the day, ideologically, not only is it about how we distribute these things, but this is about keeping a political promise. We have to do this because we said we were gonna.
Or a political promise insofar as we tried, the Democrats stopped it, we can't do any more, let's move on to tax cuts, maybe. But I want to hear a little bit more of the contentious debate or conversation or speeches, whatever you want to call it, that went on the Senate floor on Thursday following the release of the bill. First of all, I mean, we're talking about how ideology is shot through all of this. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell again on the Senate floor yesterday.
Policies contained in the discussion draft will repeal the individual mandate so Americans are no longer forced to buy insurance they don't need or can't afford. We'll repeal the employer mandate so Americans no longer see their hours and take-home pay cut by employers because of it.
So an appeal to the middle class there from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here is Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey.
The rich get richer and the rest get sicker in the United States. And make no mistake, this health care plan is of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich.
Tatiana Deering, respond to that, because, I mean, I feel like you could actually, if you remove the words healthcare, these are the ideological poles that the parties have been presenting for years now.
Yeah, they are. And actually, I don't think that kind of rhetoric or the blood money rhetoric is actually particularly helpful either. I mean, again, where we are trying to get is to a healthcare system that works well for all Americans in the United States. That being said, there are reams of good research studies out there to demonstrate that people of low incomes have zero consideration and zero political representation, regardless of how they engage in politics. Doesn't matter how much they protest, vote, give money. There is actually research done on U.S. senators demonstrating that the only priorities they are paying attention to are of higher income individuals. So there's really good data to show that whether people mean this to be about the rich versus the poor, whose interests play out are higher income individuals in the United States.
Evan Horowitz?
So for me, as a kind of policy wonk, one of the most appalling things, I used the word at the beginning, I'll use it again, about this whole thing is that healthcare is a mostly solved problem, right? There are policy issues that are not solved. Immigration is not a solved problem. That is, there is no policy around the world that has a sort of really consistent approach to immigration that works in the long. But there are polities all over the world that have workable approaches to healthcare.
Okay, so that was your clarification, because I was like, healthcare is solved in the United States?
No, not in the United States. It's a solved problem internationally. That is, virtually every other advanced country around the globe has found a way to provide good healthcare to the bulk of the population at relatively inexpensive rates. And there isn't just one solution. There are lots of different solutions, some of them more liberal, some of them more conservative. But instead of looking at the available working solutions, we seem to be starting over and crafting some Frankenstein solution that all of the research suggests isn't going to help. That's the part of it that I find most baffling when I step back and look at this whole debate.
So I wonder why that is, though. I mean, because healthcare is so central to everybody's lives. Every voter, every human being, I'd say, cares about it. So, I mean, I guess this is just me throwing up my hands and saying, I don't know why it does feel like every time we're starting from scratch in the United States when we don't have to, Tiziana.
We often do. It's ironic you bring this up. I was in Washington earlier this week looking at global responses to the refugee and migrant crisis. And granted, immigration and refugee status in the United States is not settled, but international relief and development work has a series of best practices. I used to run a domestic anti-poverty agency. People in the U.S. never looked at the solutions we'd have had in place for 20 years in an international relief and development and said, oh, hey, maybe those would apply here. There's something about our American exceptionalism that I think at some level makes us believe we got to start from scratch here because we're so different.
Well, so Evan, I mean, let me just mine your wonky expertise here a little bit. Is part of the problem that are the most of the solutions that you're talking about for other developed nations that work do involve some form, not entirely, but some form of increased federal responsibility when it comes to healthcare? And just that fact in and of itself is part of the problem here in the United States, because we will forever have that tension between, you know, state and federal governments, or, you know, individual versus big government.
I hope the answer is that we won't forever have this tension. But yes, it does seem like even the more take the more conservative solution, rather take the Singapore solution to healthcare, which has forced savings programs. So that's not government. That's, you know, individuals have to save a certain amount of money. They have no choice in that, and they use it in health accounts. Even there, you have a lot of government involvement in setting rates for healthcare activities. So you do need more government involvement for most of the international solutions. I think, however, we have come to consensus about government involvement in Social Security and government involvement for healthcare for people over 65. So I don't know that it's impossible for us to come to a consensus. I think from my perspective, the bigger problem is that we don't yet have a consensus that healthcare is a right.
Uh-huh.
And until we have a consensus that everybody has a right to healthcare that we should commit to as a collective, we'll have these kinds of disputes.
I'm not feeling very optimistic if that's the goal that we have to meet, if that's the bar that we have to clear.
I feel like we're a lot closer than we than we were 10 years ago, 15
maybe.
Years ago.
There's one more piece of tape I want to play, and that has to do with the potential local impacts here in Massachusetts. If this Senate bill or a version thereof or whatever becomes law, we're trying to figure out what the impact might be here in this state. And we talked to BU public health professor John Kingsdale. He used to lead the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector, and here's what he told us.
If there are more constraints on federal funding, would the state be more incentivized to find ways to be more efficient? In theory, that's potentially correct. But when you start with a significant reduction in federal funding, the likelihood that the state's not going to have to pick up the ball and pick up some of that shortfall is pretty small.
So, Tiziana, the other thing that Kingsdale told us, he reminded us that getting back to the Medicaid part of this puzzle, 2 million Massachusetts residents rely on Medicaid in some way, shape, or form to help meet their health care needs. So there is an enormous need in Massachusetts. And, you know, he's saying the state's going to have to pick up the ball, but we've got a $1 billion budget cap now, too, to deal with right now, no matter what.
Yeah, and that's the concern with the models in the Senate bill that not only create sort of per capita caps or block grant options, but then loosen sort of the regulations on states. Every state is different. States will be stuck, period, picking up costs that they're not picking up now, period, full stop. What we have seen throughout the United States is anytime we've created opportunities for states to have greater discretion on spending for people who are low income, some states step up and some people really leave their low income residents behind. Mm. And that is a tremendous risk here. That's why for me, at the end of the day, this is still about Medicaid.
Well, we've just got an update here, actually, that a fifth Republican senator has said he will not vote for the Senate's health care bill. That comes from Nevada Senator Dean Heller. He's told reporters that he can't support a bill that, quote, takes insurance away from tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Nevadans. Nevada is one of the states that expanded its Medicaid program under Obamacare. So obviously we could talk a lot more about health care, but I do want to give us a little bit of time at least to touch upon one or two other big stories of the week. Since we are talking about states, let's talk about what's going on Beacon Hill right here in Massachusetts about making changes to the state's marijuana law. And that could lead to a showdown between the House and Senate versions of various bills about what, you know, a couple of months ago, or actually last year, it was question four. Because on Wednesday, the House approved a measure that would increase the tax rate on marijuana. It would more than double it from 12 to 28%. And the House Marijuana Policy Committee Chairman Mark Cusack says a higher tax rate is better for the state.
It's in no one's interest to implement and regulate this new marketplace on a shoestring budget. And that's what we avoid by ensuring that we capture the revenue necessary to implement this in the best way for the people of the Commonwealth.
On the other hand, Jim Borgasani, who represents the pro-legalization community that brought the ballot question, well, he had this to say.
This is guaranteed to stall the safe and legal regulatory system approved by voters in November.
Now, Evan Horowitz, if there's one thing I love to wonk out about on the air, it's taxes! You too, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so is this a good or a bad idea? I mean, there's the will of the voters and what we passed, what the state passed on question four, and then there's the economic reality of the potential revenues that could come out of marijuana. So what do you think?
I do not understand the commitment to the 12% number. Let's start with the fact that it isn't really 12%.
Right.
It's like 3.75% going to the state. Cities can levy an additional 2%, and then there's just the normal sales tax. Usually when you talk about marijuana taxes, you're talking about the excise, the amount in addition to the sales tax. So we're more like 6% in addition to the sales tax. It seems to me you could go a lot higher than that without incurring the risk that everyone is worried about, which is allowing the black market to flourish.
Well,
obviously,
we know you can go higher because other states are significantly higher.
Other states are significantly higher. Some of them have had black market problems.
Sorry.
See, we were so wrapped up in our in our wonkitude that Evan and I get the award for bad puns of the week.
Should be knowing though. If you have bad puns, should be conscious puns.
Anyway,
yeah, lots of states out west do have larger tax rates than we do. And while some of them are struggling with black market problems, those tend to be the ones that have tax rates in the 40 to 50% range once you add in excise taxes and post-sales taxes.
Tiziana, I'm sure you have a blunt observation to make.
Actually, nice. See, that one was on purpose.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, what strikes me about this is people got upset with the House, I think, not just for the tax rate, but because it seemed like what the House was doing was trying to circumvent the will of the people through the ballot initiative. And the House sort of made it sound like that's what they were trying to do. And unfortunately, that linked the taxation question with whether or not this is trying to reverse what the will of the people was. You can have a great conversation about the fact that we could tax the dickens out of this, and I think we should, actually, to raise revenues and provide for a lot of other things. That doesn't necessarily mean that we are undermining the will of the people to legalize marijuana, but it got linked that way, mm-hmm. and I think that was the House's own fault.
Well, I mean, to that point, the Senate version, which was actually approved last night, would keep the rate which voters set in question four back in November. And here's Senator Pat Jalin on that.
We should not repeal and replace any of the referenda that have been passed, as others have recommended. We should amend and improve. That's what this bill will do.
So that's Pat Jalin talking about the
dog whistles, right?
Well, the repeal and replace, exactly. Yeah, I mean, but here's the thing: the House bill also made other significant changes, and that wasn't approved or included in the Senate version, and that is that municipal leaders, rather than putting to a vote to all residents, would be able to decide whether to ban recreational marijuana in cities and towns, because. In question four, originally, it was that it would have to be put to a vote, right?
And voters would have
voters have to approve.
I would say two things. One, I'm very skeptical of the idea that the results of question four reflect a specific overwhelming desire among the voters to have a particular tax rate. It seems to me it was a vote on legalizing marijuana with the details laid out somewhere and subject to further amendment.
Well, could it also, I mean, the way the question was written to me, it seemed like it was written by or favorable to the marijuana industry, which is, legal marijuana industry, which is giant and growing. Again, bad puns. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be. It's increasing. And it advantages them to have a lower tax rate because I guess the logic is that would not dampen sales.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if that's actually in reality or not, but
I don't think that's as big a concern yet because there's still a fight over who's going to get to do the growing and the selling and where they're going to be able to do it. And those are sort of bigger business concerns. I think one of the virtues of the ballot system we have in Massachusetts is that the results in most cases are statutory. That is, they're just laws. They don't change the Constitution, as is true in a lot of other states. And so the legislature gets to look at them and say, you know what, there's this problem with the way this is written. We need to address it and can address it with just a new law.
Well, I'm just going to leave us just a quick little second here to talk about some last minute changes that happened in the Bellabon murder trial, just really briefly, because it was kind of interesting. A couple changes or decisions were made at the end of the trial, before and after closing arguments, that essentially allowed jurors another option on whether or not to find Michael McCarthy guilty of the death of Bella Bond. And also, the judge has said that if the jurors believe that Michael McCarthy didn't act on his own, they can consider that as well, which was a change, a major change. Just Tiziana, give me your quick thoughts on that, because we've been talking to lawyers who say that could open the door to a mistrial.
Yeah, it does sound like it. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a legal scholar. It does sound like it could open the door to a mistrial. What I can't escape in my head is any of the outcomes of the trial do not create justice in this situation, mm-hmm. because what the trial really showed was that she was living a profoundly unjust life. Life was profoundly unjust to her long before the unjust death. And we can be focused on the procedural components, and probably it will lead to problems later on. But there is no outcome here that undoes the injustice that was her life all along.
Yeah, that's the fundamental truth of the case. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's shift here a little bit. And we have 2 minutes left to do our hubbubs. So these are going to be speed hubbubs today. And no, Evan, I'm pointing at you. You get to go first.
I get to go first. Mine is a local man story. You know these stories, like local man eats a whole tub of ice cream.
Right? News of 5 or 3.
Yeah.
Or
so in this case, it's local man visits 350 local parks in a year. which I love. Because I didn't know there were 350 local parks,
yeah.
And I can't believe anybody could visit that many parks, and because I happen to know the local man. And so it all comes together wonderfully for a great civic figure whose name is Ed Lyons. And I just to add what else makes this story great, he didn't do it because he loves parks and had to, you know, and wanted to take care of his. He did it because the city asked for people to visit parks and send them pictures. And he thought, oh, what a good idea. I won't just go to the ones near my house. I'll go to all of them,
awesome.
Take pictures and send them to the city. Civic life.
Civic life. Tiziana Deary, your
yes.
hubbub for the day.
I have a puppies and kittens equivalent for you today,
okay.
Right? The lighthearted.
We all need a dose of good news.
That's right. The British Beer Company up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, made a 160-foot-long lobster roll on Sunday.
That's
and
a lot of
lobster. I know, 400 pounds of lobster and 3 gallons of mayonnaise. 5,000 people came and ate it, which in and of itself, kind of fun. But then, this is so cute, they gave all the proceeds to Hero Pups, which are helper dogs for veterans who are experiencing PTSD. And after yet another crappy week of national news, I give you lobster and puppies and veterans and a giant picnic table. And there you go.
Sounds perfect. I wish I had my seat there. All right, so I'm going to give you a super fast one. Mine has to do with Girl Scouts, the Girl Scouts of America, and they are soon going to have the opportunity to be experts in a different kind of cookie. Because the Girl Scouts are introducing a cybersecurity badge.
Really?
Yes.
I thought you were going to say pot cookies.
Yeah,
I was really disturbed.
I really did.
They are introducing badges where Girl Scouts can earn, that Girl Scouts can earn once they become, they pass or do their, whatever it is. I don't know. It's been like 100 years since I've been a Girl Scout. To get their cybersecurity
awesome.
Badges. And we need young women to get in this field. So, Tiziana Deering and Evan Horowitz, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.